Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Before we bring you part two of the audio documentary Out of the Blocks from Pine Ridge, let's welcome back once again the program's producers. We're talking today with Out of the Blocks producer Aaron Hankin. He is joining us from Baltimore. Keeley Radio's Arlo Ironcloud, who collaborated with Aaron Hankin and Wendell Patrick for the Pine Ridge version or episode of Out of the Blocks. Also joining us, producer Wendell Patrick, and he is joining us from Chicago. Wendell, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
So before our last break, we were talking about sound equipment and sound mixing and this wonderful soundscape and score of this podcast. Tell me how you sort of began your collaboration with Aaron and came to really offer the things that you do for Out of the Blocks.
Well, Aaron and I had actually met about 6 or 7 years ago now, and I'm was a working musician in Baltimore and producer, and he interviewed me on his show about one of my albums, and I realized at the time he was a really wonderful interviewer. So when he approached me a couple of years later about a new project that he had in mind, I was all ears, and he asked, the project was actually Out of the Blocks, and that was the idea that he had for the show, and he asked if he could use music from my albums as background music for the first iteration, to which I offered the alternative of me writing a musical score, custom score for the episode, and he said yes, and we were off and running on the first episode, and it's been a wonderful partnership ever since then.
I love that response, Aaron. You can, like, yeah, well, we could do more. We could do better than that idea.
It's like asking someone if you can borrow their used car, and they say, well, let me actually build you a brand new Lamborghini from scratch.
So, Wendell, tell me how you approached the Pine Ridge episode. Do you travel to the site? What's your process like?
Yes, so I travel to the site. I also do all of the photography for the episode, so it's an audio podcast and radio show, but for people that find it online, there is an accompanying photo gallery of all of the subjects, and so I'm on site for that, but it also is helpful for me just to be on site just to sort of get a sense of what I might be able to contribute musically in a way that best supports the stories. I'd never spent time in that part of the country, and so it's really beautiful, and I just wanted to do whatever I could to try to sort of encapsulate the feeling that I felt the environment gave off, and also just it's always my intention to support the stories as best I can.
And listeners can go on our website at listen.sdpb.org, and after the show, we'll post a link to the original Out of the Blocks website at WYPR, and you can see the photographs and see the full transcript of Out of the Blocks as well. And Aaron, as we set up the part two, which we're going to play here in just a minute, this part has a feature of with your family, kind of bringing your family into the conversation. What was that decision like to sort of open up the door to, you know, to folks in your own circle?
Yeah, that was quite a leap of faith, Arlo. I don't know, Arlo. You know, I was very touched that Arlo invited us to come and hang out with his family. You've got a great family, Arlo. I'll let you say a few words about maybe who they are and why you wanted them to be part of this story.
I think maybe we have, we're going to go
connection
ahead.
And problem with Arlo?
We might have a little connection problem. We'll fix that. But in the meantime, let's go to, because in the podcast, we hear from his family directly. So here is part two of Out of the Blocks.
From WYPR and PRX.
It's a special edition of Out of the Blocks.
From Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota.
It's one neighborhood, everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Things are different now than they were back, you know, whenever our ancestors are alive. Our enemies, back then, we knew how to prepare for them. Nowadays, the enemy is invisible.
the United States said that our children need to be educated. And they started what Captain Pratt said in the Carlisle Indian Industrial School is, kill the Indian, save the man.
Our knowledge of our culture wasn't priority with us growing up. It was just all about survival.
Through our culture, through our ceremonies, it's already been prophesized that there's a seventh generation that's coming forward that's going to create change. And I see it.
We're all here to survive. One heart, one mind, one prayer.
From producers Aaron Hinken and Wendell Patrick,
in collaboration with Arlo, Ironcloud, and Keeley Radio,
Voice of the Lakota Nation.
It's a special edition of Out of the Blocks,
right after this.
Couple of quick words of context as we get ready to jump into part two of our podcast from the Pine Ridge Reservation. You'll remember last episode meeting Arlo Ironcloud, our co-producer and partner on this collaboration. You'll remember him telling us,
I want you to meet women's rights activists, American Indian Movement members, students, teachers. I want those people that aren't always heard to be heard.
Well, among the many people Arlo introduced us to during our time together were some members of his own family. And during this episode, you're going to get the chance to meet Arlo's wife, Lisa, his son, Leroy, and the remarkable man whose voice you're going to hear now. This is Arlo's dad.
My name is Richard Ironcloud. The original Ironcloud was born in 1856. He married two sisters. One of the significant things that happened in his life was he was part of the what they call Custer's Last Stand, or, you know, part of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He was there, you know, and my grandma's, they got their names from that battle. One of them was Red Necklace, and then my grandma was Annie Runswerhill. And the reason why they called her Runswerhill was whenever the battle was going on, she was helping the elderly and children to get to safety in the hills. My other grandma, her name was Red Necklace, and she was a singer. When the battle was going on, she was on a hill and she was singing these, what they call Braveheart songs, to give the men courage, you know, and she was singing those. And as the battle was going on, these men would kill these cavalrymen and they would take their, they had these red neckerchiefs on. And she was singing on this hill. They would come by and they would put these neckerchiefs on her arms. And they said at the end of the battle, they said that her arms were all full of those neckerchiefs. And so that's why they called her Red Necklace. That was her name. In 1973, I was in high school, and I remember there was a man that was killed in Gordon, Nebraska. His name was Raymond Yellow Thunder. He was killed by some three young men. And when they went to trial, they let all of them go, you know, just with a slap on the hand. And here there was some his relatives. They went to one of our leaders in Porcupine named Siebert Youngbear and told him, you know, that they wanted justice. And at that time, because they had killed Raymond Yellow Thunder, the whole tribe was unified in against his death and those three young white men that killed him. And whenever you come together as groups, you know, the people get scared of Indians whenever they come together as a group and for a common purpose, you know. And that's what caused some of the problems, you know. And it was almost like a civil war on our reservation. The government came in and tried to stop it. I remember coming home in the afternoon on our bus, and here they would have these like bunkers, you know, like on top of these buildings with machine guns on these buildings. There was a group, they decided to take over on that community called Wounded Knee. And they, I remember we were driving around that night, my uncle and I. We came by that four-way in Pine Ridge, and here there's a whole bunch of cars coming from the north. They weren't stopping at that stop sign, they were just going on. So there was like a caravan, and I guess that night they took over that town of Wounded Knee. And that started the 73 days, you know, and people from different tribes, they all came and they all wanted to be a part of it. And so they were all sneaking into Wounded Knee, you know, to help with the protest. There were some people that died. A man by the name of Clearwater, he was shot. And he was in that church. There was a church there. And I think one of the bullets came through the church and got him behind the head. And then there was another guy named Lamont that was killed. And there was also some of the federal marshals that were wounded there too. And so they called a truce, I guess, and then they negotiated, you know, I guess how they were going to get people out of there. When I was 18 years old, I lost both of my parents. It was kind of a difficult time for us, you know, because my brothers and I just stayed at the house there, and I worked there, you know. But seems like most of the people that were around us at time were drinking, and so that's what we spent a lot of time doing, was drinking. We were able to keep our jobs and stuff like that, but we spent a lot of time drinking and getting into trouble, you know. I'm really glad that I was able to get sober, you know, because that's really been like a foundation, you know, that I've been able to live by, you know, to be sober and to learn how to cope with life without alcohol and drugs, you know, because life is difficult, you know, it's really hard, and it's easy, I think, to go and, you know, to use drugs, you know. And one time there was one of our elders in Porcupine, he wanted to revive those old societies, those old warrior societies, and so he called us all over to his house. They had us all sitting in a circle, and all of us young men, and they brought in some elders. I think one of them, he got up and he said, "Things are different now than they were back, you know, whenever our ancestors are alive." And he said, "Our enemies," he said, "back then we knew how to prepare for them. You know, we knew who they were. We knew how to become a warrior. We knew all the weapons, and we knew how to confront our enemy. You know, and nowadays," he said, "they're different. The enemy's invisible," he said. What he was referring to as invisible was things like alcohol and drugs, and, you know, like suicide, and, you know, all these things that are currently impacting us on the reservation, you know. And he said, "Those are our enemies now. In order to deal with those situations, we have to become spiritual warriors," he said, "to be able to deal with those things."
My dad is, in my opinion, the greatest man that I know. My wife is an amazement as well. I cannot fathom how somebody like her can get out of the situation that she's ever been in. For her to come out alive as well is something.
We're making chokcherry wasna, which is kind of like a pudding. But instead of using flour, we use timsala to thicken it up a bit.
You hand grind this timsala, yep, with the mortar and pestle.
Yep, or stones from the creek. My name is Lisa Ironcloud, and Arlo Ironcloud is my husband. I think it was his long hair, initially. I thought he was pretty handsome. My upbringing is completely different from Arlo's. We lived up here in Rapid City the majority of my life, but we were always, we were pretty nomadic. We couldn't stay in one spot for too long. We were homeless. We lived out of the car. There were days where we would go without eating. You know, it was a lot of struggle. And our knowledge of our culture wasn't priority with us growing up. It was just all about survival. My parents were fluent Lakota speakers, but they didn't introduce us to ceremonies. So whenever I made my path and met up with this guy, with Arlo, I kept thinking that I didn't want my children to go through what I went through and to have a better understanding of where they came from as Lakota people. So I tried to play catch up and talking to people who are willing to talk to me, which was a struggle in itself because you have a lot of people who have knowledge, who have a really great idea of where they come from and they know the history, but their willingness to share with other Lakota people, I mean, no offense, but you know, a non-Lakota, they're so willing to share that information. But when it comes to Lakota, it's really difficult. It's almost like territorial. So it was hard. But there were people out there who were willing to sit down with me and work hands-on with me and then teach me the stuff I should have known at this age. You can grind it. And it's not gonna get totally fine. But I run it through the sieve like this, and then it catches the bigger pieces, which I still use. I'll put those in soups. Our circle has really grown a lot by, you know, us just asking for help.
I've been hearing that Facebook is very popular in the community, which is it's a kind of an irony that, you know, you've got this sort of modern internet social network keeping people together for traditional purposes.
Right. Like my personal Facebook page is just dedicated to food, just showing other people what's out there. So I can post this and say this is pte talo pusiapi, which means it hangs to dry. That's why it looks like this. I could easily do a photo or a video or something explaining how we do this, you know, and then somebody, because we get a lot of that response where they're like, thank you for sharing that because I didn't know. I had an idea, but I didn't know.
We're going to walk out this way just a little bit. There's a powwow grounds out here, which is a nice round facility where we have our graduation outside in June. And if you come up here in June, there'll be teepees and people camping, and we'll have 40 or 50 people get a degree here. But if we turn around and we look, the building is supposed to be an eagle landing on the prairie, and you can see its eye, and you can see the front of the eagle and the tail feathers and the wing feathers, and it's landing on the prairie. It's supposed to be representative of nature. So, yeah, this is cool stuff.
My name is Ted Hamilton, and we are at Piawi Choni, which is the administrative building for OLC, Ogallala Lakota College, here literally in the geographic center of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. We have nine districts across the reservation. Each district has a community, and in each community there is a college center. We have faculty traveling from center to center offering courses, everything from Associate of Arts degrees to bachelor's degrees to master's programs. Our total enrollment is just right at 1,300 students. I think the best thing that I did was know nothing when I came here. I was at the University of Iowa finishing up a degree in archival studies at their library school, so I have a master's in library science. And they had a job opening for an archivist. The college had never had an archives before. So I came out here and I said, I'm gonna stay here for 3 to 5 years, I'm gonna teach people how to do it, and I'm gonna move on. And then I fell in love. And so, you know, you fall in love and things occur, and that's how, actually Arlo's over there is my nephew because I married his aunt. So I've raised a few kids here, and we've been here ever since. I have some really good friends here. I have been, I think, marginally accepted by most folks. As a non-Indian, you move in and you become part of the community. I have nieces and nephews and grandchildren. All of that kind of happens, and I think it's kind of organic. Mostly the learning I've had is just through conversations with all kinds of folks across the years. One of the things I've learned is that every student who comes into my classroom, we have an opportunity to learn from each other. And I think the real trick as an educator is not to come in with a set of blinders on and saying, I'm an expert at this, but to be really, really open to the fact that there's just a lot of learning to be had here. This is a memorial to the veterans on the reservation, and Native people have played a pretty crucial role in most of the wars. Per capita, we have more people volunteering and being medal winners
than any other ethnic group or any other group actually in the country. And you can see going back from World War I, so World War I, a number of names on World War II, Korean War, Vietnam. What's interesting to me as a historian is that all those names on the World War I plaque, none of those were citizens of the United States because they didn't get citizenship until 1924. And so here you have literally dozens of names of men who went over into Europe to fight, and they were fighting for their homeland, but not necessarily for the country, or for the government, I should say, but really for the country, for the homeland. And that to me is an amazing thing. And I can see names like John Black Cat. I have a really good friend of mine, Willard Black Cat, who's a direct descendant of these folks.
From the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, it's one neighborhood, everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Out of the blocks.
I'm Leroy Ironcloud, and we are looking at a buffalo hide.
We're in your backyard here, and this thing is strung on a wooden frame. What do you, what's the process here?
Well, a couple days ago it got really hard, so I couldn't work on it. Because you can see there's still fat and meat still left on there. So, and now that it's raining, I'm waiting for it to get soft again so I can start working on it again. So, see these PVC pipe things? See how they have these little grooves on the edge? They're kind of cut at an angle. And then you kind of hit them off. This is all good right here. You see that? And then this is the meat. This is as far as I got. So it's kind of getting frozen too, so.
So you use this PVC pipe as a kind of a scraper to get the meat off of the buffalo hide?
Yeah. Okay, so see? That's the part you want.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. Today, we're bringing you the audio documentary Out of the Blocks. This immersive listening tour of Pine Ridge was created in collaboration with Arlo Ironcloud of Keeley Radio. Let's get back to the story.
This one is a 2017 all-wheel drive Dodge Charger with a V8 Hemi in it.
Yeah, no one's going to outrun you in this thing.
Haven't yet. So she gets along pretty good. I think the highest I've had this one was about 154.
My name is Ken Franks. I'm the captain of highway safety here on the reservation.
My name is Kevin Rasher. I'm the lieutenant of highway safety.
We enforce all the traffic codes like the highway patrol does for the state. We enforce all those for the reservation. That's what we do. On the average day, we get out and we run our roads. We have, 1,800 miles of documented road on the reservation. Our reservation is about the size of Rhode Island. So we get out, we run the radar, making sure people are slowing down, making sure that this roads are safe for the kids going to school.
DUIs, part of the job.
We have a dry reservation, but just like back in the 20s when they had prohibition and stuff, it's only as dry as you want it to be, I suppose. Just like everywhere else, you still have the same problems. We have DUIs here, but not any greater than anywhere else. We live in a community. I live in the Pine Ridge Village community. I live there. I've lived there since we've moved here. Like you said, he lives in the island over in the Pass Creek community. So if you get to know your community, you get to talk with your community. It's the concept of community policing, but I believe it as a human instead of just under law enforcement.
When we train people or train officers, I always tell people, treat them the same way you want to be treated if you were in their shoes and they were the cop coming to your house.
You guys are such an interesting duo because you're two non-Lakota guys who both ended up here because you met Lakota gals, and now you live here and this is your home and your world, and you police the streets here. I imagine that sort of human community-focused attitude is probably especially important when you think about the kind of larger political history of where you are.
I'm gonna be honest with you, when I first started here, yeah, it wasn't a real reception for me, being non-native. Again, I'm follically challenged, if you can tell this.
you're a pale man, a bald man.
I'm a pale, bald man. Yes, I am. So when I first started, it was tough going because you figure it's back in the 90s, not too far from the 70s, with winning the occupation and all this stuff. So you're still fighting off stereotypes. Like on the reservation, I would get all the jokes or all the name calling. They would call me Casper, Custer, all these different, you know what I'm saying? All these different things. But through the years, people have gotten to know me. A lot of the officers in the bigger cities will live in a different community and come and serve in a different area. So they don't have any connection with the people that they're serving. I got interest in this. My kids go to the school here at the Red Cloud School, and I have relatives that go to the Pine Ridge School. Like he's got children that goes to Bennett County, Little Wound. And
anybody can wear a badge and do the job that I do. But it takes somebody to be a human being to treat somebody as a human being.
Charles Newholy, CharlesNewholy. I suffer from post-traumatic stress because I grew up around a time when there was radical change here. This was a time when Wounded Knee occupation was going on, and we had our house shot at several times, and my dad made this crawl space underneath the floorboards. You know, so when cops came to, you know, raid people's houses that they believed were helping the Native American, or the whatever you want to call it, American Indian movement at the time. And our house was one of the houses that was always getting raided or whatever, because it was a drop-off point for the supply route that was going into Wounded Knee at the time. And we run into these roadblocks where people were getting pulled out of their cars and the cars were getting searched and whatnot. And I remember seeing these guys with guns and all of this, and they weren't police officers at the time. We known them as a goon squad. Back in 73, I was a kid then. You know, I didn't quite understand what was happening. But here's where you're like, you go through these stresses because you don't know what's going to happen to you on a daily basis. You could be playing outside and get shot at, or you could just be going to school and get shot at, you know. So those are those stresses that people here have, is that post-traumatic stress that was caused by these effects of the Wounded Knee occupation back in that days. When you keep a people oppressed and depressed, you have complete control over them. And assimilation policies were being really pushed hard on people. But traditional people back then still believed in their rights, you know, like we still do. We still have our treaty rights. The treaty that the United States government had signed with us, they recognized us as a nation. But in 1934, that was changed when Congress came up with the Land Allotment Act and then the division of the Great Sioux Nation into tribes. We aren't tribes. We're actually one big, giant tribal nation. Right now, we're looking at our own termination. Because right now, on this reservation, according to the enrollment, there's only 400 full-bloods left. 400 full-blood Lakotas left on this reservation. The Blood Quantum Act is something that we need to get rid of.
So blood quantum is a European concept, yes, of what part this or that you are in terms of your family tree.
Yeah.
And that concept then got sort of transposed onto the Native people here.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Like if you take a full-blood Lakota from Oglala Sioux Tribe, and then you take a full-blood Lakota from Rosebud Sioux Tribe, they marry and they have kids. By that Blood Quantum Act, that child becomes a half-breed of either or tribe. But reality, that kid is still a full-blood because of these two full-blood Lakotas. So you get rid of that law, you have a lot more full-bloods in what they call the Great Sioux Nation. We have like some younger people here that are full bloods, but they're labeled half or less than half.
And those labels then determine, in the eyes of the federal government, what they're eligible for or not eligible for?
Yeah. Yeah. Treaty obligation says that if you're half or less, you don't get the full treaty obligation rights that the full bloods get. Eventually, Congress is going to say, hey, where's the full-bloods Where are the people that we made these treaties with? We're all here to survive. We're one nation. One heart, one mind, one prayer.
My name is Bruce Whalen, and I was born here 56 years ago on the Pine Ridge Agency. And the stories around here are typical for my age group, and they're still typical now. My dad was an alcoholic. He had a job with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He was able to go out and get stinking drunk the night before, and somehow he had managed to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, smoke his cigarette and read his book, and he'd make us oatmeal, and he was able to be a functioning drunk. And most of his friends were the same way. Anytime I ever saw family or friends, we were watching them get drunk. I used to volunteer myself as a five-year-old and run back and forth to the refrigerator to get their beers for them, because if I got to open it, the suds that came off means I got to sip it off. So here, after running back and forth as a five-year-old back and forth to the refrigerator, I remember that when I was older, some of the people at the parties that were had, they would say, "Brucey was such a good boy. He was so quiet." And I thought back on it. I says, "You know what? I was probably drunk." As I was growing up, I wasn't protected by my dad. There's things that happen to me that's typical that's happened to a lot of kids on a reservation. You know, you feel kind of malignant because you were used by other people, and pretty soon you kind of have the attitude that that's how my life is I'm kind of useless other than for other people's pleasures. And one day my dad is laying on the couch in his stocking feet that he always does when he gets off from work and rests for a while, and the police knocked at the door, and I opened up the door, and they just walked right in, walked past me, picked him up, put him in handcuffs, and hauled him out in his stocking feet. And then I found out that my mom and dad were divorced at that point. I had no idea what was going on.
What happened? What did the police pick him up for?
I don't know. Irreconcilable differences is what the divorce decree said. My mom says, "We're going to go down and spend the night at your aunt's house, and then we're going to go for a drive tomorrow." Next thing you know, we're driving through the mountain ranges, and we pulled into Salt Lake City, and when we saw the hotel that my mother was looking for, she pulled into it and she says, "This is where we live now." I was working in Provo, Utah, and I got transferred up to Oregon. I was printing. I was a lithographer, making very good money, $25 an hour, and benefits and convenience of Portland. And my sister called me. She says, "You know, Dad had a heart attack." And I said, "I heard." I didn't get along with him. Really had no compassion whether he had a heart attack or not. And she says, "You know, he might not be around, and wouldn't you like to come home?" And I said, "No, not really. I'm making a life out here now." And it took a little bit of etching on her part to say, "You know, maybe you need to change your mind." And so I did. I moved home. And probably the best 11 months that I've ever had in my entire life with him was moving back in with this man that I learned to hate over the prior 37 years of my life. He wasn't a man of a lot of words. What I noticed when I was going through the community, he used to trail me. If I stopped in the building, I noticed, what's my dad parked there across the street for? And we got home, and I said, "Why are you trailing me? I want to see who you are as a man." I thought, wow, I wish you would have done that when I was a boy. Kind of getting hostile feelings. So then we started talking a little bit. I says, "You know what, if you're going to see what kind of man I am, then maybe you should tell me what kind of man you were, because you weren't there for me." He says, "Well, I went to boarding school. I didn't know how to be a parent."
Let me just have you say a few words of context about what boarding school means. People may be listening to this on the East Coast and have a very different sort of idea of what boarding school means.
Sure. Here, what was set up over a century ago is that the United States said that our children need to be educated. So they set up schools. And the thing is these schools, they might have taught you ABCs, but they didn't teach anything about parenting. What they taught you was stand up straight. You know, they cut their hair off so that they couldn't identify themselves as a tribal person, because our hair is really important to our culture. And they started what Captain Pratt said in the Carlisle Indian Industrial School is, "Kill the Indian, save the man." And my dad, he went to boarding school. He said, his mom and dad were convinced that it was the right thing because that's what everybody did and that's what the government told them to do. So they drove them over to boarding school and they stopped in front of the sidewalk leading to the doorway. They told him to get out. This is where you go to school. Then he walked up to that door and his life changed. When I started understanding my anger about him and he started sharing some of the things that I needed to hear that I didn't hear prior, it helped us to stay in the same room together and make comments toward each other. We did two things. We watched Star Trek. We loved it. And we watched Friends. Our ritual was is we'd get ready, turn on a TV, he'd make the announcement, and then he'd go make popcorn, pour some milk, and we'd sit down and watch. When he was dying, I communicated with him, and we figured out a code. I put my finger in his closed fist, and I'd ask him questions, and one for no, two for yes. That's how we communicated when he was in the hospital. And it was a very, very short period of time that I was able to do that with him.
You felt like you got to say to him the things you needed to say and to hear from him the things you needed to hear before he passed away.
No, I never feel like I've had that conversation with him.
If you could speak your mind to your dad, if you still were able to have a chance to do so, what would you say at this point?
Well, I would say, truth be in my heart, I'll see you soon.
My name is Darla Black. I'm the Oglala Sioux Tribal Vice President. What I do is I help the people when the people come into the office, and there's various needs. Sometimes it has to do with housing, child care, just a variety of things that the people might need, or they need assistance, financial assistance with getting to Rapid City for a medical appointment. But at the same time, we also provide a sack lunch to the homeless people. And so my office is a continuum of movement. I really focused on the elders and children when I ran for office. When I walked around through the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and I talked to people rurally, a lot of people that lived like I did when I was young. You know, I was indigent. You know, I didn't have clothing, adequate clothing. But I shouldn't say we were indigent because we were rich. You know, sometimes we only had flour and water, and my grandma made wonderful bread and gravy. But the teachings, the spirituality, everything was there. My roots here is I'm from here. I am from a community called Manderson. But when I went to college, I went away. I moved to Nebraska. And then midway through my career as a law enforcement officer, I went to Reno, Nevada, Lovelock, Nevada, and Shurs, Nevada. And I worked as a law enforcement officer down there. Upon the death of my grandmother, I came home, you know, because my mother started having heart attacks and health problems. So I stayed here with her, and then I went back to school. And the same thing, I came back because my mother developed cancer. And watching her clear up until she took her last breath made me appreciate life, made me live life like today is my last day on this earth. So how do you do that? You enjoy life. You respect one another. You love one another. Being an elected official like this, it is them who that we want to work for, these children. We want to work for a better future for them. And through our culture, through our ceremonies, it's already been prophesized that there's a seventh generation that's coming forward that's going to create change. And I see it. And you know what? They're growing their hair. You see his hair? They're growing their hair because our hair is a part of who we are. I had long hair, but I cut it when on the death of my mother. My hair was down to here. And the beauty of that is they're turning back to the ceremonies. They're turning away from alcohol. They're turning away from drugs because they see it all around them. They don't want it anymore. And they realize through our teachings, through our spirituality, that don't belong to us. It's not who we are.
You
You've been listening to a special edition of Out of the Blocks.
Produced by Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick.
In collaboration with Keeley Radio, voice of the Lakota Nation.
Special thanks to Arlo Ironcloud of Keeley Radio.
And WYPR's Katie Marquette.
Aaron and Wendell want to thank all of us who took a deep leap of faith
and shared our stories and our lives.
From WYPR and PRX.
This is the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Signing off.
Signing off.
Signing off. Doksha ake.
And you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. If you haven't already found this Out of the Blocks from the Pine Ridge Reservation online, we can help you get there on our website at listen.sdpb.org. After the show today, we'll post some links so you can get there directly, where they have transcripts and full audio, also photographs of all the voices that you heard here on today's podcast. And we're going to close the show with bringing our producers from Out of the Blocks and Arlo Ironcloud back into the conversation here. So we have with us Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick and Arlo Ironcloud. And Aaron, I want to start with you this time, because there's this moment where you're hearing the story of a boarding school, and I'm just intrigued by this, because you get it right away that that's going to sound different maybe on an East Coast audience, yeah, where you're from in Baltimore, that boarding school means something entirely different in a different context. So talk to me a little bit about how this particular Out of the Blocks sort of fits in with the overall mission and the work you're doing.
That's a great question. It's an education to show up in a place where you don't know the first thing about it, and to just start from scratch. When we do our episodes here in Baltimore, we live here, and so there's a certain, sort of established common ground of understanding. I think it was interesting. You heard earlier in the episode, Arlo's uncle, the professor from Oglala Lakota College, said the best thing he could do was to show up knowing nothing. I showed up knowing next to nothing. I read some books. I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. I read Black Elk Speaks. So I had enough of a sort of, I was able to have semi-intelligent, historically based conversations with people. But it's interesting to, when you visit other places, even places as different as Pine Ridge, there are, fundamental, universal human points of connection that you make. I mean, there are a lot of things that are going on at Pine Ridge that, are similar to issues in Baltimore. Drug and alcohol issues, homelessness issues, and they look different, they sound different, but they're, essentially some of the same fundamental human stories wherever you go.
And Wendell Patrick, from a musical standpoint, then you have hip hop artists and you have a musical connection. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Do you mean specifically the hip hop artists that we interviewed, or?
Well, I mentioned what Aaron said about the sort of, these human points of connection, and it strikes me that the music and the soundscape and the soundtrack is also one of those things that sort of brings everybody together, including the hip hop artists that we met in part one. So talk a little, if you will, just about music and the universality of it.
Well, definitely for me, it's constantly a learning experience, just in terms of sort of being aware of where music exists and can be helpful. I mean, we watch movies, we watch commercials, TV shows. There's music sort of constantly there, but it's I think different when you have the responsibility of not only curating a listener's experience to stories, but also I certainly feel the responsibility of making sure that I don't put my own personality above the message that's being shared. And so I think the universal aspect and nature of music is very helpful in allowing people from different communities and different parts of the country or world even to listen to a program such as Out of the Blocks and hopefully connect to it.
Arlo, one of the themes that it seems people were coming back to again and again is this notion of culture and traditional ways, and how many people are in one place and then find their way to a better place and a more authentic place and a healthier place through language, through ceremony, through understanding history. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, sure. I think, excuse me, one of the things that's really misunderstood that I see is the spectrum of understanding of who we are. I mean, through boarding schools and colonization and different things like that, a lot of our relatives, our ancestors, their hair was cut. I mean, so we really can't put a straight line down to say that this is how you grow up Lakota and this is how you become Lakota in this day and age. So it's a really broad area. And so whenever I think about like South Dakota race relations, I think about how, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of years of this going on, and only recently the decades of healing and self-discovery, language revitalization, that's only been in the past few decades. So until our people really get a handle of who they are and who they were, I mean, it's the only way as South Dakota we're going to go forward.
And Aaron, I think you also, exactly what he just said, you know, we hear that in the story of Bruce and his father, when you see that there was pain, how hard it is to overcome that, how hard it is to reconcile it on a deeply personal level, but then that personal pain is part of a broader cultural pain. Talk, Aaron, if you would, about this notion of telling these bigger stories through these micro, you know, relationships. This conversation that's really about one thing, but it's about so much more. Do you know what I'm getting at there?
Yeah. I think it's the idea of when you meet someone on their own terms and you just show up to listen. We like to say we have the radical agenda of having no agenda. You know, we show up not with the idea of telling a certain story about a place, but to letting that place tell its own story. And so, you know, some people want to talk about their dad. Some people want to talk about their car. Some people want to talk about their music. And, you know, I always feel like you can end up with a much more real, authentic, and genuine and interesting conversation if you talk with someone about what they want to talk about, not what you want to talk about. And then when you take all those different slices of life and you add them together, it's like as much sort of significance as any one story has when you listen to them in succession, like you've played the both parts of this program, you know, you get this bigger picture, like a mosaic. Each tile sort of contributes its part to that bigger picture.
When you know when you have it, Aaron, when you're doing all this, you know, cutting and switching and pasting, and I don't know how you map it out. Do you have a big whiteboard where you move post-it notes around? Like, how do you, and what point? So tell us a little bit about that process of putting all that tape together. Yeah. And then when do you sit back and say, yep, that's it?
You're exactly right. I have lots and lots of sticky notes all over the place. You know, it's interesting, the ratio of how much audio we collect to what we use has a, you know, sort of a great impact on how things finally sound. I mean, Arlo will attest to the fact that we hung out and talked for like an hour with everyone we met. Yeah. And then when you hear them on the program, you hear them maybe for 3 minutes. So that hour is really spent sort of honing in with people on what is most meaningful to them. And then it becomes, it's almost like you end up with all these songs and you figure out like, well, what order do I want to put these songs on an album? You know, if you think of it, it's like a giant concept album, which makes sense coming after who? Do I put Charles Newholy after I put the two highway safety officers? Does that make sense? How do those two stories rub against each other? How do they resonate with each other?
Arlo, what happens next now that this work is done and you've been able to hear, you know, the result? And I want to circle back to something you said when we first started our conversation with, you know, the number of people who come through the Pine Ridge Reservation and want to tell a story, want to take a picture, want to, you know, have a conversation. After Out of the Blocks, for you, has anything changed
I guess I'm a little bit more open to people coming to visit. I get, whenever I work at the radio station or just in the community in general, there are people come and they want to hear about my perspective on Wounded Knee. I mean, not me in particular, but like in general. And I usually kind of turned off by it because we have so many like one-hit wonders come into our communities, get the exposure or they get the accreditation that they need, and then they're gone, you know, and I don't like that. And so whenever I hear about media entities like Aaron and Wendell, I appreciate it because they shared our stories. And so that's kind of what's been my goal, is I want to be able to be more efficient in storytelling. And that's what I'm going to do at the radio station. I'm just going to make sure that I'm more efficient so that I'm able to tell stories better and in a more consistent way. So I'm excited about their visit, and I was very fortunate to run into these two. And I've actually put out several stories recently in the same style format through Keeley Radio and through a podcast that I have with Thunder Valley CDC.
Nice. Aaron Hankin, and I can echo Arlo's comments about being in radio and learning so much from just just listening to this today. So, Aaron Hankin, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
It was an absolute pleasure, and thank you, Arlo. It does my heart good to hear your voice, and I'm glad you're making good stories.
Wendell Patrick, thank you so much for your music. Thanks for being here as well for the conversation.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
And Arlo Ironcloud, thank you so much. We're here together, so don't be a stranger. Reach out to us anytime.
I hear you. Thank you very much.